I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. If last night's primaries are any indication, we're going to hear a lot more about political passion and determination and the pursuit of high ideals from both parties in the months ahead. The word we don't hear is money. Today on The Connection, we'll check in on last night's results with that in mind. For example, John Edwards and his first win in South Carolina.
Will we have the strength and conviction to make this vision of hope and optimism into a reality? If the American people give me a shot at George Bush next November, I will give them back the White House.
Now, you see, the strength and conviction that Edwards speaks of is also a reference to the cash he'll need if he wants to stay in the race. John Kerry is the one with the luxury of being able to look ahead. What he's saying is that the battle against the Bush war chest will be an even more difficult one.
Now we carry this campaign and the cause of a stronger, fairer, more prosperous America to all parts of our country. And we will take nothing for granted. We will compete everywhere. And in November, we will beat George W. Bush.
Over the course of the last three presidential elections, Charles Lewis has provided something of an underground Bible for people who follow the money trail. The latest edition is called The Buying of the President 2004. Now, we want you in on our talk about money and politics. Is the race for the presidency more about money than message? Does the candidate with the most always win? Is that such a bad thing? And if so, what should be done about it? Also, if you're one of those people who gives money to politicians, we'd like you to call and tell us why you do it. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, in a few moments, we'll be talking with Charles Lewis about the power of money in politics. And just a note for those of you who can follow along on our website, we'll have links to the public integrity site that Charles and his people maintain, as well as some lists of who's giving money to who as we talk about the trail in this campaign. You can find us at theconnection.org. First, though, we're going to check in with Ryan Lizza. He's associate editor of The New Republic, has been all over the place covering this campaign. This morning we find him at a public radio station in Colchester, Vermont. Ryan, nice to talk with you again.
Oh, nice to be back.
Are you sleeping?
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, I found myself in Burlington last night watching the returns with the Dean campaign. I decided that rather than go hang out with one of the campaigns that were actually competing yesterday, it might be kind of fun to be at Dean headquarters as they sort of watched the election results roll in on a day when they actually didn't have any contests that they were expecting to win. That's why I'm up here in Vermont.
What was the mood like in that room?
Well, I have to say, it was sort of, it wasn't as down as you might expect. It was just sort of, they have this strategy where they decided to skip yesterday's contests and concentrate on this weekend and then on into February 17th, where they're hoping to turn the whole campaign around by beating John Kerry in Wisconsin. And there was a sense that, hey, we knew we were going to lose seven states tonight, and let's just keep our chin up and see how we do this weekend in Michigan, Washington, and Maine. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like watching the returns as if they weren't in the election. You know what I mean? They were just sort of watching the returns of some election that they weren't actually a part of last night. It was a little strange.
Now, we'll get back to the money side of that in just a moment, because that plays so key in the Dean strategy. But I promise you, I won't play that little piece of tape of John Kerry describing himself as a patriot winning on the road again. But I do want to talk about where he is now, where he's heading. Is his climb through the pack still really the only story of the Democratic campaign?
Well, I think not. It would have been if he had won all seven states yesterday. But I think we have a new storyline. We have Kerry as the sort of dominant front runner. And we have three candidacies that have strategies of varying degrees of ridiculousness to take him out by picking and choosing the states they're going to play in over the next month. I think that most pundits who sort of decide these things agree that John Edwards, is the most formidable opponent to Kerry right now, because he won South Carolina. He's sort of in a statistical tie with Clark in Oklahoma, pending the certified results of that contest. Although it looks like Clark may have edged him out. And I think that's the sort of battle that a lot of people will be watching right now.
So do you mark this still as four people? Do you mark it as Dean and Clark and Edwards and Kerry? With Kerry well
out? I do. Yeah. I think even though Dean didn't win yesterday, he's sort of things are looking pretty bad for that campaign. But his strategy right now is not that much different than Edwards' strategy, which is target a few states. You're not going to win everywhere over the next few weeks, and you can't challenge John Kerry everywhere. But you can pick a couple of targets and hope to sort of wound Kerry and hope to be the last guy standing and have a sort of face-off with John Kerry. And that's basically the strategy for all the sort of, what you might call the anti-Kerry campaigns at this point.
Okay, General Clark, though, I mean, we're talking here about a man who, as you point out, is in a virtual tie in Oklahoma, not showing particularly well anywhere else. I'm going through my lists here. I guess a reasonable appearance in Arizona with 27% of the
second place.
Yeah, but so where's the life in that campaign? Where does that go from here, Ryan?
I don't know, and this gets into the rest of the conversation about money, and that's really what's going to determine who survives here, because these guys will stay in it until they run out of money. And I think the Clark campaign is looking to next Tuesday, February 10th, when Virginia and Tennessee vote. And I think they're even more particularly they're concentrating on Tennessee and see if a little bit of Clark's southern roots can get him a victory in Tennessee. Of course, Edwards and Kerry will be playing very hard there as well. So of all the campaigns, I'd probably of all the challengers to Kerry right now, I'd probably want to be in the shoes of John Edwards, just because he had such a clear victory yesterday, and he has a sort of argument he can make that I think the other guys can't. I mean, he won a state that in a region that John Kerry hasn't shown any strength in yet, and he won decisively. Clark's victory is sort of muddled in Oklahoma, and his money situation is questionable.
Okay, Ryan, stay with us for a bit, if you will. I want to bring Charles Lewis in. Charles, as I mentioned earlier in the program, is executive director of the Center for Public Integrity. It's a nonprofit watchdog organization in Washington that does investigative reporting on public policy issues, and also author of the latest edition of The Buying of the President. This one's The Buying of the President 2004. Charles is joining us from the Christian Science Monitor studios in Washington. Charles, nice to have you on the program.
Nice to be back.
Can you, in your experience, look at the scenario that Ryan has laid out for us and say, you know, a candidate can hold his breath for a week or 10 days and try to make a showing in a primary that you know, would resuscitate the campaign? Is that something that can happen?
Well, that's what makes life interesting. And almost anything can happen. I mean, look what happened with Kerry and Dean a couple months ago. But if you're talking probabilities, it's not likely. I think everyone would acknowledge these are, you know, frankly, a little bit of long shot scenarios. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go back over the last 20 or 30 years, there have been candidacies that have kind of kept going throughout the primary and caucus stages, and in fact, sometimes winning several states. Who can forget Frank Church? Who can forget Jerry Brown? There are lots of, over the 70s and 80s, there have been instances of late surges that statistically and even in terms of delegate counts will not be hugely significant, but a point's being made or a candidate is saving face or whatever. And we're not at that stage exactly, but obviously the next couple of weeks are very, very crucial to these other three gentlemen trying to challenge Kerry. And the question really has to do with this weekend and the February 17th contests. And you're right, they're picking their states. And if they pick their states and lose, as Lieberman did last night, they will drop out, I would imagine. At least you would think that one or two of them will at least. So So, but it's not likely. And,
okay, but Charles, when you
watching.
Talk, excuse me, but when you talk about them picking their states, what you're talking about is choosing places to run television advertisements primarily, rather than choosing a place where they're going to, you know, run from arena to arena trying to meet people.
Well, you're right. It's running ads. There's only a few days. They're not going to be doing a lot of person-to-person meeting and greeting in the state. Most of it will be probably via the media, which requires a lot of money, yes. But it's also a regionalism. Obviously, Dean is going after Wisconsin and Washington, and Edwards and Clark are trying to target some of the southern states, and Kerry keeps saying he's running a national campaign, and he is trying to basically run in all the states. And, you know, we've seen these kinds of scenarios before with other candidates over the years, and usually the targeted state thing keeps candidacies alive, but it doesn't amass large numbers delegate-wise, and that means ultimately there's going to be a problem. But I think there's also a collective thing, whether anybody wants to acknowledge it, of the campaign not quite ending. I think a lot of people want to have some more drama over the coming weeks subconsciously. I mean, it's not supposed to be anything official, but you do have the sense that people don't want to wrap this up just yet, and they want to get a sense of how strong is Kerry and test him. And but the whole pundit and political reporter group and in general, everyone watching it, this movie's not quite over in terms of the primary stage.
Yeah, I will admit that campaign reporters have an incentive for this thing to carry on, and so as in any way we can develop a storyline where there's a real contest, I think we will.
Charles, one of the rules that you folks have marked through the years, I think for about the past 30 years, is that those candidates who have the largest war chest at the end of the year prior to the election, that would be December 31st of this past year, are the people who go on to represent their party in the election. Is that going to be broken this year? Is that rule about to stop being a rule?
Well, it is. It's already broken almost sort of as a technicality. It is an amazing statistic. I mean, it's an uncanny statistic that midnight, December 31st, the year before the election, the candidate raising the most money, and here's the very important qualifier, and eligible for matching funds, that is to say, playing by the post-Watergate rules with spending limits in states and overall caps on spending. So playing by those kinds of rules, the candidate with the most money the year before the election has gotten the nomination every single time, with that exception since 1975 through 2000. Now, here's the rub. This time, Bush, Kerry, and Dean, the three front runners or leading candidates in their respective parties, have all opted out of the system, are not eligible for matching funds, because of their own choices to spend as much as they want in key states or go way past the overall cap on spending. And so, you know, because on its face, Dean raised $40 million last year, the most of any Democrat ever, actually, in any presidential contest, more than Gore, more than Clinton. And he would have seemed to have been the one based on that statistic. But the problem is Dean, Kerry, and Bush have all opted out. Now you've got Kerry, who's dumped several million into his own campaign, which changes that equation. And, of course, Bush has raised $130 million. So that is a great factoid that is going to be more and more of a footnote of history because it's not
right.
A moot.
I have to stop you there, Charles, and remind our listeners we're talking about money as the fuel behind politics this hour. We'd like to hear from you on the program. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. We're taking a look at the results of last night's primary elections, but also ahead. And we're trying to understand what the money means at this particular point. Talking about money, this past weekend, Governor Howard Dean was on Meet the Press and made a rather frank admission about just how important money can be in a campaign like his.
We spent a lot of money in Iowa and New Hampshire trying to win. We were trying to do essentially what John Kerry is now doing. We were planning on trying to get the huge momentum out of Iowa, and it didn't work. We took an enormous gamble, and it didn't work.
This hour on the program, we're talking with Charles Lewis, who writes the book, The Buying of the President, 2004, and Ryan Lizza, who's associate editor of The New Republic and covering the campaign. Ryan happens to be in Vermont right now. And I guess, Ryan, when I listen to Dean make that kind of admission, I'm curious to know whether or not there's a Hail Mary somewhere in that campaign's back pocket. They say, we tried this, it didn't work, we're not going to run in the five that ran last night. Right. Is there a bit of magic ahead somewhere?
Well, you know, the Dean campaign, I have to say, despite the fact that they spent a shocking amount of money to win Iowa and New Hampshire, I mean, $40 million, that's more than any Democratic candidate has ever raised before mm-hmm. the election year. They spent that on two states. They do have their donors, their grassroots donors have not given up on them, and they're actually continuing to raise money at a pretty decent clip. I think they were telling me yesterday as much as a quarter of $1 million on one recent day. So that's one. I think when the story of this campaign is written, and we've talked so much about the Dean movement and the Dean grassroots, including on this show, I think the grassroots movement that Dean built has proved to be an incredibly effective fundraising mechanism, but not such a great mechanism for getting electoral support. It didn't really do much to organize or bring voters to the polls in Iowa and New Hampshire. But it is the sort of silver lining they have here. They can keep going a little bit longer, maybe like the Energizer Bunny Rabbit, as Dean compared himself to last night, because they do have this donor base that hasn't decided to give up on Dean and is still pumping money into the campaign.
Charles Lewis, you're the one who actually goes into the back pages and figures out precisely where the money's coming from. When we look at the way Dean's raising money, is he really changing the rules, rewriting the rules here?
Other candidates have tried using and have used the internet, including in the 2000 election. What Dean has done is absolutely astonishing historically. To raise 800,000 or a million in a single day via the internet, and to amass the kind of numbers he amassed in 2003, as a former governor of Vermont, which is a state with campaign limits, very little media, not much of a financial base as a candidate. He's not from Texas, et cetera. He has changed the way campaigns are going to utilize the internet. I do think whatever happens in this campaign, people will talk about Dean's use of the internet for years to come. The way other campaigns, pioneered the use of either polling or, personal jets or, TV ads in the mm-hmm. 60s. I mean, this is a seminal moment in how a campaign is run. And what's so fascinating about it to me, of course, is this understandable swoon that occurred by journalists, because in the year before the election, the only thing you have to cover is the raising of the money. There are no real events anywhere. I mean, no primaries or caucuses. And understandably, everyone noticed this cash coming in astonishing amounts from all over America in relatively small amounts, and it is so unusual. It's a man bites dog story that a lot of the boomlet in interest in Dean and then the media coverage and then the momentum and all those overused words, it actually did create a bit of an inflated sense of the importance of Dean, maybe looking back. I don't know. We're going to have to study and think about this campaign for a long, long time, but how someone could be ahead in the polls in two states and collapse the way he did, I do think will be examined for many, many years.
And we will be looking later on in this program at the other candidates, where their money's coming from, what it is that distinguishes them at this point. But let's hear from people about money and politics and where they think the two fit together. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. First to Palm Coast, Florida, and Chris is joining us. Chris, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks a lot. Good morning.
Yeah.
Well, for me, it's been an interesting process. I actually had a fundraiser at my house for John Edwards back in February of last year. I saw him. My wife really liked him.
A year before anybody's thinking about it.
Yeah, no, I know. And very early on, you start realizing, they're trying to build money. And quite ignorantly, because while I like politics and I read a lot about it, I've never been involved in a campaign. And then you start working. I went to Iowa, and I was in South Carolina and making phone calls late yesterday to Oklahoma to try to get people out to vote. And you start realizing the economics of it. I own a couple of small businesses, and you start seeing trying to run a national campaign, and you realize that the numbers are enormous that they're trying to put together at $2,000 a maximum per person. And you realize how that infrastructure you have, that whether it's Kerry and all the years that he's had in the Senate or being a governor for so many years that, that Bill Clinton was able to put together and amass relationships, and the same thing with Bush, you start understanding that money, when you're trying to work in states where you're not going to be on the ground as much, having the ability to be up on the air or being on the networks is
the Chris, are you
to
saying
your
that,
name out.
Yeah, if you can't, if you're not with someone who can raise millions in a single evening like President Bush is able to do at his fundraiser, you're saying there's a sort of lost cause feeling about the whole exercise?
No, not at all. Not at all. But there is an understanding and a realization that, that money, your ability to get your message out over and over and over again, makes a big difference. I mean, when I look at Iowa, for example, I know that the Edwards campaign spent $3 million in Iowa, and Kerry spent a million and a half more. And you know that when you look at 6 percentage points and you've talked to the people and you've made the phone calls, you know if those numbers are reversed, you probably win that state. So you start realizing at that point that money really does make a huge difference.
You know, the fascinating thing about this, Chris, thanks for your call, is when you look back, and Charles Lewis, I know you've been paying attention to this, at the Kerry campaign before it resuscitated itself in Iowa. It did it on the strength of the candidate's own money, not stuff that people gave him, but something like $6 million from a mortgage on his Beacon Street home in Boston.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, his campaign, as we all know, was 25 points down. It was a pretty badly run campaign, or at least it was having trouble getting traction. And by the way, he wasn't doing very well raising money in the first 6 months of the year, partly because Edwards surprised everyone with 175 fundraising events in the first 3 months and astonished a lot of people that a freshman senator could attract that kind of interest.
175 in 3 months?
In 3 months, which is almost inhuman to contemplate.
It's 2 days.
That's a lot of frozen
terrifying.
Smiles.
Yeah, no kidding.
It is terrifying. It's troubling that anyone would have to go through that to do any. The idea of Harry Truman and Abe Lincoln going to those lengths to get elected is a grim thought. But back to Kerry, if you know, Kerry's 6 million, I do think it's. There have been articles about this. Everyone has sort of acknowledged. I mean, that 6 million was, an infusion of everything into his campaign in December. If he hadn't dumped that money into his campaign, I think a lot of people do believe he would not have won Iowa. And if he does get the nomination, I believe he'll be the first millionaire candidate to help himself to the nomination with the use of his own cash since John Kennedy in 1960. Most of the people that spend a lot of money that we're familiar with, the Ross Perots and Steve Forbeses and John Connolly back in 80, of course, did not get the nominations of their parties. They spent a lot of money, what seemed to be wasted a lot of money in terms of the ultimate result. But if Kerry does emerge and continues to, you know, move forward here, it will be the first time in whatever it is, 40-some years, where a candidate's personal money helped to get the nomination directly. And that's really intriguing and unusual and noteworthy, I think.
Now, Ryan, you were there in Iowa at the time. Do you remember that moment when the money came in? Did you see the change as the ads came on television?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not just the ads, but the mail and the whole level of Kerry's organization just sort of stepping up. Although I have to say, a lot of people weren't paying attention to Kerry when he wrote that check.
Right.
He wrote that check at a point when he was just being written off by the press and the pundits, and people were thinking of Iowa strictly as a Dean Gephardt battle. The money that was spent did sort of slip by without people noticing. And then sort of in the final 2 weeks when Kerry was sort of making his comeback, you sat in your hotel room in Iowa and you couldn't watch a commercial break without seeing one or two Kerry ads.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely noticed this huge infusion.
1-800-423-8255. We're talking about money in politics. One of the little facts from Charles Lewis's book is that in 1980, there was about $150 million spent on television ads. In the year 2000, over $1 billion spent on television ads. I got to get myself a television station. Before I do that, I'm going to Nashville, Tennessee. Mark's on the line. Mark, hi.
Good morning.
So what do you think about money in politics, Mark?
Well, first of all, I have to get this out of the way. I've always told myself if I've had the opportunity to tell Chuck Lewis what I thought of him, I would. Thank you for that website. I have been a follower.
I thought this was going to be bad news.
I was bracing myself.
So we're going to get ready to hit the kill button here. But Mark, go ahead.
I've been following the Center for Public Integrity website for a couple of years now, and it's just an invaluable source of real, discernible information that it's really changed the way I look at the whole political spectrum and, indeed, other things as well. So I do appreciate what you and your people do. Now, in regards to money and politics, I think that, you know, we've seen these unprecedented things happen this year with the Dean campaign, and my wife and I are supporters of Dean, and we were very energized early on by the fact that so many people were contributing these small sums of money and feeling like they were part of this grand movement. And we still have that feeling, and there's still a lot of that out there, and I think that's one thing that Dean has brought to the Democratic Party as far as just teaching us that we can be energized in this way. But less and less, I think that the money becomes just part of the television campaign for the advertisement. And I wonder, and this is more of a question, I guess, for you, or maybe just a comment, how do we factor in this thinking the kind of coverage that a more consolidated media brings us outside of the advertisements? And again, John Kerry could never have afforded the coverage he got for the I Have a Scream speech that they kept repeating over and over in the media. Now, but, I don't mean to berate. Yeah. I don't think it's fair enough, Mark.
I mean, everybody, I think, has made that observation. But, Charles, if one of the points that you make, if I did my homework properly, is that in the buying of the president, the reason the television ads count for so much is that the candidates aren't getting the coverage that they might like, and so they're, in effect, buying coverage, right?
Well, that's right. Free media coverage is not what it used to be. In fact, there have been studies. The 2000 election was substantially less coverage by, for example, the TV networks as 96 or 92. And so it's more and more difficult to get covered. If you've noticed last night with the primaries and caucuses, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to see anything on the networks until 11 o'clock or later in the evening after their primetime programming. And so cable then does it. But the problem is, with outside group ads, at least cable is increasingly, or at least I should say occasionally, they are blocking ads, choosing not to run certain ads. And all of these companies have agendas. I mean, they are all giving to the two parties. I mean, a lot of money. Like we did a study in 2000. It was $75 million spent by media companies to try to influence the political process themselves while their reporters are covering politics. And there is kind of a strange confluence there of those things. This is a long conversation, and there are a lot of sort of conspiracy theories, and there's all kinds of things about it. The bottom line is it's a confused mess. And the central reality is if you're a candidate, you must pay for media because you cannot depend on news coverage the way you maybe could 10, 20, 30 years ago. There is a different dynamic today. And, you know, when you talk, we interviewed Jimmy Carter for this book and lots of other interesting folks, Bob Dole and John McCain and others. And Carter is seething about this. You know, we're one of the few advanced democracies in the world that does not have free airtime for politicians. We're the only leading democracy in the world that doesn't have it. Even most of the Latin American countries have it, for goodness sake. And so Carter feels that the media companies are profiteering from democracy, and he uses verbiage like that. He and Walter Cronkite and Gerald Ford and others have been trying to advocate for change about that. But there is a real issue here that is offensive to many people around the nation.
Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin next. Daryl's on the line there. Daryl, thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning, Dick. This is a very interesting equation. There's a whole lot of different factors that are involved in this, and really this big emphasis on money contributions early in the candidacies of these candidates is a little bit self-serving as far as the media goes. Actually, money is not as big a determinant as many people think it is. For example, when you have that many debates and when you have the news commentary on those debates, the emphasis and the focus is really on the message and the candidate messenger. Now, when it comes to Kerry and Edwards, Kerry has the presence and bearing over Edwards, but Edwards has the telegenic and the charisma over Kerry. Now, you got to remember
You're saying money doesn't matter, Daryl. You're saying money's not as important as...
No, it's not as important because if the message doesn't hit an emotional point and focus on the problems that the people are having and that they want addressed, then your message... I know there's a lot of trickery in the messages.
Yeah.
There's a lot of tomfoolery in the messages, and a lot of people are fooled. But intelligent people will vote for the one who is really standing for them, and they'll see through all this camouflage.
I wonder, though, in fairness, what percentage of people would qualify in that intelligent category, the people who are watching the debates, the people who are, you know, going to websites or reading different newspapers or watching television. I mean, Ryan, what Daryl is saying is kind of putting it back on the shoulders of the media to say, okay, this person is interesting or this person isn't interesting, and evaluating them based on that. Is he right?
Look, I would agree with some of what he's saying. I think we can overstate how determinative money is. I mean, let's look at what happened with Dean over the last year. He tried to buy Iowa and New Hampshire by breaking out of the cap system, building this incredible grassroots fundraising network, and spending $40 million to win these two states, and he came in third and a distant second. So there are limits to what money can do in politics.
And a good point to make there is the I Have a Scream speech came after the people had voted in Iowa, not before.
That's right. You know? It came after. Exactly right. And your other caller made the point that free media still matters. The way that the news media shapes the candidates still matters, and all the money in the world can't always overcome that. And we've seen plenty of candidates with unlimited resources who just failed to excite voters. I mean, Steve Forbes in 96 and 2000 didn't go anywhere. Ross Perot couldn't win the election. Mm-hmm. So I think we can overstate how determinative money actually is in these campaigns.
All right, Connection listeners, let me ask you to join us on this conversation. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We are talking about the importance of money at this point in the race for the Democratic nomination, but whoever emerges from this particular fight is going to have to face George W. Bush and quite a fearsome war chest that's been gathered together by the incumbent president. So perhaps we should look a little bit ahead as we move on through the hour at what comes next. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's for you to join our conversation this hour about money and politics. With me on the program, Charles Lewis, Executive Director of the Center for Public Integrity and author of The Buying of the President, 2004. Ryan Liz is also with us. He is Associate Editor of The New Republic, and he is covering the presidential race. We're going to Danvers, Massachusetts next. Sally's joining us. Sally, thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. Great discussion, as always. I just wanted to ask your panelists if they could talk a bit more, and if I missed it earlier, I apologize, but about the lopsidedness of money on the Republican side versus the Democratic side. And, you know, I'll lay it open. I'm a Democrat. I'm partisan. But even when you... In my most objective moments, I look and I think $170 million that the Republicans will be able to raise. And, in fact, Republicans always outstrip Democrats when it comes to money. And, sure, John Kerry put his own money into his campaign, but at least we know the source of that money. You know, it was family money. And I don't know the answer to address this lopsidedness of resources from one side to the other.
Well, you can look up in a book like The Buying of the President 2004, Sally, who's giving money to the Republicans and who's giving money to the Democrats. But I want to, Charles, ask you to sort of weigh in on the point that she's trying to get at. And we know mm-hmm. that the Republican Party has this reputation as a more pro-business party. They tend to attract more money from businesses. But when we look at the ability of either party to raise money under campaign finance reform and whatever rules they live under. Now, do the Republicans have an edge?
Well, and so-called hard money, contributions, direct contributions to candidates, they have an astonishing edge. In fact, American politics has never seen numbers like this. Bush shattered all records in 99 when he raised almost $70 million, roughly $230,000 a day, to Gore's $84,000 a day the year before the election, and everyone was astonished by those numbers. He's raised $131 million last year, and he's got $99 million on hand. And the way he's done it is by bundling contributions together in the most sophisticated organized system of bundling, getting multiple people from the same company or industry and getting credit with numbered checks and things. We thought there were 222 pioneers. We've now discovered there were 600 pioneers in the last election.
600 pioneers, each one delivering $100,000 small contributions, right?
Right, that's right. And I would, first of all, it's Republicans traditionally, you're absolutely right, have raised more, generally speaking, going back 30 or 40 years, and are perceived to be and financially have been closer to business overall over that time. What makes this unusual as a time in history is this particular Republican candidate, not his father, not Ronald Reagan, has found a way to bundle contributions in an astonishing way. Where I'll give you an example: in '99, there were 19,000 people writing checks. No one, Dole, Clinton, Gore, could find more than 19,000 people to write the maximum check. Then it was $1,000. Now it's $2,000. Bush found 58,000 of them. All over America.
All legal, though. All straight up.
It's all legal, but here's the reality today. All the Democrats essentially are raising the same amount of money Clinton raised. And Clinton raised $26 million the year before the election in 95, and so did Dole. In 99, Gore raised $30 million before. And Dean raised $40 million, but remember, we doubled the limits. Now, some of his contributions would be the maximum amount, and the doubled limits are helpful to all candidates, including Dean, and so it's a slightly different game. But so the Dems went up to $40 million. No other candidate raised more than $25 or $26 million the year before the election. Dean is the exception.
So all we're really saying, Charles, is that the Republicans are better at it than the Democrats. They're smarter.
Well, they're better at it, they're smarter, and, you know, there is a closeness to business. Now, what are Democrats to do, which is what your caller is asking?
Right.
The Democrats have a strategy. This so-called political organizations known as, it's an IRS number, 527 groups, these outside groups that run ads and do all kinds of campaigning, but not explicitly necessarily for a candidate. There are now 20,000 of these organizations. They're proliferating like rabbits. Our website has all of them. And a lot of Democrats, including billionaire financier George Soros and others, are spending millions of dollars. And actually, the outside groups, Democrats are leading Republicans 2-1 in how much is being raised for those groups. And their strategy is that in March, when the nominee for the Democrats is pretty clear, that period from March to the summer, the Democrats will, generally speaking, be out of money. Bush will have his massive amount of money in direct contributions, but they'll probably also have outside groups. And there's going to be a war on the airwaves and other kinds of campaigning throughout the nation, grassroots, you name it. And the Democrats want to be competitive. So they have decided as a strategic matter, and it too is legal, but it is controversial and it's new, is to raise this outside money to try to match the Republican advantage, both Bush's personal advantage and the traditional advantage the party has.
Ryan, you've been hanging out with the Democrats. Are they saying that, uh-huh, that they can make a fair fight based on the money side of it?
Well, this is what Chuck's talking about has a very important effect on how this election is going to play out next year. Because of McCain-Feingold, the Democrats basically gutted the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party relied disproportionately on soft money. They can no longer get that anymore. So these groups, these 527 groups, had to step in to fill the soft money vacuum. So you have one party, the Republican Party, which will raise the majority of its cash in hard money, both the Bush campaign and the RNC. You have another party where the DNC is basically a shell that can't compete on the hard money front. So its message is now going to be controlled by half a dozen what conservatives might call liberal special interest groups. And these are the groups that the Democratic candidates are going to have to rely on to get out the vote, to contact voters, to do the mailings. And the DNC will know will have given up a lot of its message and strategy to these independent groups, and the candidates themselves are barred by law from coordinating in any way with these groups. So it'll create a very interesting dynamic. You know, say you have a candidate who doesn't agree with the philosophy of one of these 527s,
right,
or has strategic differences. They're now dependent on these groups for victory. I'd much rather be in the Republicans' position than in the Democrats. At least the Republicans are controlling their own destiny to a larger extent.
Let's go next to Hollis, New Hampshire. Robert's joining us now. Robert, thanks for calling.
Thanks. Good morning. I am a volunteer on the Kucinich campaign, and I've really become sensitive to this coupling between money and visibility since this campaign isn't really rolling in the stuff. One of your guests commented a little bit on alternatives, pointed out that in a lot of countries, free airtime is available.
Yeah.
I wonder if we could cover again the idea of alternative to the way we do things now. Have people really given any thought to other mechanisms for getting campaigns rolling?
Charles?
I mean, well, there are all kinds of alternatives and all kinds of reform proposals, probably literally with scores, if not hundreds of them. Free airtime is one way. Public financing of elections, of course, is starting to occur in a few states, but generally it has a ways to go, I would say, an understatement of the year there, in terms of the way campaigns are financed. The debates are a big issue. Talk to any person who can't stand the two parties. The debate commission is controlled by the two parties, and the last two presidential elections, third-party candidates were excluded from the debates. The Federal Election Commission has two parties, six people, three and three, three Republicans, three Democrats. So if they want to investigate federal law abuses of election laws, they can't because there's a 3-3 deadlock, and so they just don't investigate. So, which is why reformers want to reform the Federal Election Commission. But outside voices, whether they're third-party voices or they're underfunded, there is a problem right now, probably, at least from their perspective. They can't get heard. They can't get noticed. And there is no real serious proposal at the moment. McCain-Feingold, of course, didn't really deal with this. It dealt with soft money, the large contributions to parties, and how issue ads are run and other kinds of details. But it did not address this particular issue. And you know, the fact is, with presidential campaigns, but also House and Senate campaigns, you do need money. 40% of the state legislative races in America have no opponents, partly because people don't want to raise money for a state legislative seat. And Congress, you have to have $1 million to run against the incumbent to have any chance of winning, $4 to $5 million for a Senate seat, and roughly $30 to $40 million to be serious as a presidential contender. All of this required a year before the election. Limits your talent pool, and a lot of people, a lot of good folks, don't get into politics frequently because of these kinds of issues. Or if they get in, they're barely in. They're in because they want to get their message out to the extent they can, but they know they have absolutely no chance.
Some pretty staggering numbers you're going through there. I want to go to Foxborough, Massachusetts. Melissa, you're listening to that. $4 to $5 million for a Senate seat, 30 for a president. What do you think?
I think it's quite ridiculous. I'm 28 and involved. I think it's wonderful, you know, all the campaigning that the president does. However, I think that we need to reseat some of these people in the Senate and in Congress. For an ordinary person to put up with that money, what's our chance? I mean, I think that we need to get a team of people together and create a new party, because Democrat, Republican.
Melissa, I'm going to stop you, not because I want to cut you off. I'm just having a really hard time hearing your cell phone. Ryan, she's talking about creating a new party, but I mean, I don't know whether or not that's realistic. Is there even a mechanism to address something that Charles pointed out earlier, the fact that the matching fund thing is now an anachronism in national politics?
Well, you know, part of it goes back to one of the root problems in politics in general, and that's participation. People aren't checking off that that box on their tax return anymore, so that the matching fund system is being gutted. And one alternative, one campaign finance alternative is greater participation. I think when people look at a campaign like the Dean campaign versus another campaign that's getting most of its money from high-dollar donors, they think there's something slightly more democratic and participatory about a campaign that funds itself, even if it's in the end large sums of money, but funds itself through small-dollar donors. And I don't know how you actually accomplish this, but one way I think we'd all feel a lot better about the system is if the candidates at the national level were getting lots and lots of checks, right, of small dollar checks than a few large checks. That's one thing. What the Dean campaign's shown us that is possible.
Charles, you started looking at this back in the mid-1990s and drawing people's attention to the way that money influenced politics. But in recent years, with victories of people like John Corzine and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Mayor Bloomberg, I mean, it's more and more the case that ordinary people in America look at politics at every level and say, it's all for sale. It's like it's getting worse rather than better.
Well, it is true. That's how I feel. I mean, it's a little frustrating to watch. But, 40 members of the U.S. Senate are millionaires. Less than 1% of the American people are millionaires. So you go into politics, you're either a millionaire or you're able to raise millions of dollars from, vested interest with business before government. 96% of the American people don't contribute a penny to any politician or party at the national level. And a check of $2,000 comes from 0.1%. And the other stat that is devastating, I think, is in every single federal election cycle, over at least 100 million Americans stay home. They do not participate. And so we have a problem here with our democracy, whether anybody wants to admit it. We have an incumbent retention rate in the House of Representatives that's 98% the last three elections. Sounds like North Korea, but we're talking about the United States of America. Now, that's partly money. It's partly redistricting shenanigans where you do a gourmet district for yourself, a designer district where you have everyone that thinks like you do voting for you perpetually year in and year out. But right. So there's a lot of things that are wrong right now, but I agree completely. Participation is the key, and public has got to get engaged and enraged and start making themselves known. And a lot of excitement about Dean, whatever anybody thinks of Dean, is there was a new group of people out there that were interested, and they were using new ways of communicating, the internet, and that's a sign of life where I come from. That's interesting to me.
Charles, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Well, thank you.
Charles Lewis, Executive Director of the Center for Public Integrity, author of The Buying of the President 2004. Ryan Lizza, nice to have you with us again.
Oh, thanks so much, Dick.
Ryan Lizza, Associate Editor of New Republic. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.